Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. Today we're talking with Jonathan Witt. He's a senior fellow from the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. He's co-authored with Benjamin Weicker a really great new book called A Meaningful World. How's it going, Jonathan? Thanks for coming on.
Pretty good. Hey, Jason.
All right, let's just get right into your book. Explain the title to me, A Meaningful World.
The title of the book, A Meaningful World, sets itself against a worldview called materialism, which says that the world is just matter and energy, that you and I are just so many subatomic particles bouncing around in a rather self-involved way. And we say that, no, the scientific evidence points toward a world that is overflowing with meaning. Moreover, that there's evidence of design at every level. We go even beyond that and say that the evidence points toward a genius. The level of physics, chemistry, biology, we can see the same qualities that we find in human works of genius, though in this case to an even greater degree.
I was wondering too, at the end of your prologue, you describe your book as an antidote. How does it work as an antidote?
Well, yeah, we use an anecdote to explain why our culture needs an antidote.
Watch out.
Watch out. Okay, that was a groaner there. So I'd have to pay people for having to hear that one. But in a nutshell, we say that reductionist materialism, this idea that reality is just so many particles, so much energy swirling in the void, is doing great damage to our culture. In the arts, it's causing people to deny that great works of genius mean anything. It's causing us to deny that human life is worth anything more than a clump of dirt. It's poisoning the very notion that human life is sacred. And we try to present not a religious argument against that, but we try to show that if you open up the book of nature, you see that the evidence points in a very different direction. It points toward a universe designed brilliantly so that humans can live in it and even discover things about themselves and about reality through the scientific enterprise.
You're saying as well that you can extrapolate from the meaningfulness of the big picture down to the little picture as well, and vice versa. This is different than in the Darwinist works, how they say basically that the universe is meaningless, therefore everything can be reduced to the sum of its parts, and that can suck the meaning out of things. How is it that you came to this conclusion that the universe as a whole and then the individual parts have meaning?
Well, let's take something really, really basic in terms of science, and that is the laws and constants of physics and chemistry. Used to be that they would look at those in isolation from biology. But now, there's a whole field called astrobiology that's tying those two fields together because they're saying, wait a minute, the laws and constants of physics and chemistry appear to be finely tuned to allow for not just life, but advanced life. For instance, take gravity. If gravity were even a little different, our universe wouldn't be a place where you could have planets, stars, or even human beings. And there's a whole series of parameters, electromagnetism, on and on, you could go on the list, that look like they're balanced on a razor's edge to allow for complex and advanced life. And so we're saying, look at the harmony in nature. And that's, by the way, one of the qualities of genius that you find in works of people like Shakespeare, Mozart. There's a harmony. It doesn't mean everything's smooth sailing and there's no trouble. It means there's a fascinating interconnectedness to the whole work, and we see that in our universe because those laws of physics and chemistry, when you go and you start studying living things, the most intricate, most complex things we know of in the universe, the laws of physics have their deepest meaning only when you go and you look at biological life, because then you say, oh, wait a minute, now I see why this and this and physics had to be tuned just so.
So a brilliant endgame would be one of the signs of genius that you've
detected. Right, you could look, you read the first act of Shakespeare, and you go, oh, that's pretty interesting, you know, now that I figure out what he's saying. But then you read the whole play, and you go back again, and you look at the first act again, and you're like, wow, look at all these threads he's laying down that are going to pay off in such a fascinating way later. That's what the universe does. We go back and we look at what's going on at the beginning of the universe, what the physicists and cosmologists call the Big Bang. We look at the laws of physics that were present there, and we're starting to realize, wow, look at these finely tuned physical constants of nature are just so to allow, not for the universe to evolve unaided, but to allow the universe to end up a place where things like plants, animals, scientists, one type of animal, can exist and prosper.
Now, let me ask you this. You guys argue, obviously, as a part of your book, that we have not only uniform experience in detecting design, but we also have uniform experience in detecting genius. And my question to that was, isn't genius a little too esoteric to boil it down to a list of characteristics?
I think that's a good impulse. If you've ever seen the film Dead Poets Society, there's this page in the book that the teacher has them read, and it's got this graph where they can figure out something about the quality of a poem or something like that, and it's very reductive. And of course, one of the things we take on is reductionism, the idea that you can dissolve everything into its parts. At the same time, you can look at a certain group of things and look for common elements. Now, we don't argue that every work of genius has to have the four elements that we pull out and focus on, but we do say, if you do find a work that has extraordinary depth, has extraordinary clarity, extraordinary harmony, and extraordinary elegance, you're certainly looking at a work of genius. And we show that in Shakespeare. We show that in the great Greek mathematician Euclid. We briefly touch on other types of artistic work. And we show that when you find those to an extraordinary degree, you're looking at a work of genius. Then we turn and say, look, we're finding those same qualities in nature.
Now, let me ask you this question. I know your background is in literature, and so my question to you was, how did you approach this in the sense of there's the science behind intelligent design theory, but now you guys have expanded this into the arts and sciences? What was it about this particular subject of genius that led you to believe that that would be yet another evidence for design?
Well, what pulled me in is I've studied the science. That's not where I did my degrees, but I've studied the science around a lot of these, and so has Ben Weicker. But as I was studying some of the works of Darwin and Darwinists, I saw that they would often make aesthetic arguments. Aesthetics is a field of philosophy that I specialized in that deals with beauty, art, how to assess the works of art, how to identify genius, that sort of thing. And I saw that the Darwinists actually brought in aesthetic arguments against design. They would say, well, if a designer had done it, he wouldn't have done it this way. He would not have engineered the panda's thumb to not have an opposable thumb, or he would not have wired the vertebrate eye backwards.
The bad really design arguments.
Yeah, these are aesthetic arguments. And they'd say that was not very effective design, or he wouldn't keep reusing DNA throughout the biological realm. Any self-respecting designer would move on to different design platforms at every turn. And again, I found that if you looked back at the basic common principles of aesthetics, assumed not just in the West, but in the East as well, what the Darwinists were assuming was completely out of the mainstream for aesthetics, and yet they were presenting them as if they were just common sense assumptions that everybody should agree to. So I wrote a piece in Touchstone magazine calling attention to this. Ben Weicker saw that. He had been working in a parallel fashion on some similar material. He saw that article, called me up, and we started working on looking at, well, what if we look at this harder, if we look at nature as a work of art, if we think of it as a work of art, how does it measure up? And one thing led to another, and here's the book.
I think that's fascinating because reuse of certain elements, reincorporation, a theme running throughout, those are all elements that we would recognize in Shakespeare or other good literature or even in artwork, Monet, others. And yet the Darwinists have been saying the same can't be true for the natural world.
Right, yeah, but like they take the fact that DNA is throughout the natural world and say, oh, an all-powerful designer wouldn't have to keep going back to that. He could be much more creative. He wouldn't have to keep having life forms be carbon-based. He could go all over the place. Well, there's a tremendous harmony to the biological realm because the designer did continue to reuse certain themes. Can you imagine somebody walking out of a great symphony of Mozart's and going, oh, he kept reworking the same three or four motifs throughout the symphony. It was maddening. The person would be locked up in a place where they had to get lessons in music theory for the next 6 months if they did that.
Which is exactly it, because in nature, seeing the reuse of a theme, I'm not sure what the term is in the musical realm, but the recapitulation portion, which was so much a part of classical music for so long, is incredible. We see that as a work of genius. And now you're saying, of course, that in nature, if we see that, that should be a telltale of genius as well.
Right, and when it's just a little bit of harmony, hopefully if I sat down and wrote a play, I'd have a little bit of harmony in it. We're saying that in nature we see that tremendous level of harmony. And again, we don't mean by harmony that everything's hunky-dory and there's never any difficulties in anybody's life. But we're talking about that interconnectedness of the way the universe is put together and how, for instance, we now know that physics and chemistry relate and find their highest meaning in biology.
Let me look ahead then, because you guys are saying that not only can we detect design and purpose, but now we can detect genius in at least a somewhat uniform fashion. So help me figure out what's coming. If your ideas take hold as far as looking for genius, not because it's arbitrary, but because it's actually there, then what does this mean? What will change in science and in culture when this idea of detecting genius takes hold? What would that look like in science? What new research or in culture, what effect will this have on the arts?
The short answer is everything and nothing. Let me pick up nothing first. The reason nothing would change is because science, the scientific revolution, was founded in part on the assumption that the universe was the rational product of a rational mind, a tremendous rational mind. All the early scientists, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, Copernicus, all said they were trying to find this rational order. Kepler, I think, said, "I was thinking God's thoughts after him," when he discovered these elegant laws of motion in the solar system. So in one sense, we would be returning to what fueled and fired the scientific revolution in the first place. And a lot of scientists have never left that. So that's the nothing would change. But the everything would change in the sense that there has been, in the 20th century, tremendous push toward this materialistic worldview, this denial that nature is ultimately rational and meaningful in the work of a great genius. And that's been poisoning our culture. We give examples, even in biology, where that's actually slowed progress. So I think we would see an acceleration of scientific progress. We would see a more beautiful culture, one where human life was valued and beauty was sought in art and architecture rather than frowned upon as something passe or suspect. So I think the impact would be at every level.
Now, I want to let folks know that there will be a book party there in Seattle.
There's a book party August 22nd.
August 22nd, that evening. Do you know where that is?
That's going to be at the Discovery Institute. That's downtown Seattle, 3rd and Pike. And you can go to discovery.org and get the details of exactly when that is and how to get to the building. That should be fun. We'll have snacks and good time.
Good old time.
We'll have a good old time, that's right, yeah.
For our Texan friends here. Now, also, there will be a website coming out in regard to this as well.
That's right, and it is out and up, and it is www.ameaningfulworld.com.
Ameaningfulworld.com, and the book party will be the evening of the 22nd of August, and you'll be there signing books, and Benjamin Weicker, your co-author, will be there as well?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. That sounds excellent. Well, I hope that folks who are going to be in the Seattle area will turn out for that. In the meantime, please pick up a copy of A Meaningful World online at Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com or at discovery.org/CSC. Jonathan Witt, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Jason.
This is Jason Anderson from the CSC. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID to Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com. And check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.